From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Future Science with Maurice Cotterell. Here's what's happening. While the risk of nuclear war rising because of global tensions and insecure stockpiles, according to some experts, this is not a good thing. They say that urgent action is needed to minimize the risk of a nuclear war. More than 120 senior military, political, and diplomatic figures from around the world got together and they made this decision. They said we need to be careful. This is another bizarre story. 36 dead bankers or reporters in the financial sector. 36 of them. Let's check in with Doug Hagman, of course, from Homeland Security U.S., not affiliated with the Department of Homeland Security. Doug, this is a bizarre story. Have you uncovered anything on this?
George, yes, I have. As a matter of fact, I've been on this since the beginning of the year. And, you know, we're being lied to at multiple levels. First, let me take issue with that number, 36. It is upwards of 50. I can verify 49 and a little more, but probably another half a dozen more. So about 55 in total that I know of, as opposed to the 36. But look, I've been an investigator for 30 years in the private sector for major insurance companies and Fortune 100 companies. And this is part of what I did. I would investigate suspicious deaths, especially where the high dollar amounts are involved, you know, multi-million dollar policies, key man insurance for banks and even insurance companies. And my territory was New York City, New York, and a lot of this, so I know what I'm talking about here. From my experience visiting a lot of death scenes, I can tell you that the reports I've seen, including some of the investigative reports, police, and autopsy summaries, are not consistent with what we're hearing in the media in terms of the methods and means of the deaths. Details are being twisted. Facts are being covered up, if they're being released at all. And if you would plot this on an actuarial chart, the numbers are just off the charts. So, and according to my sources on this, by the way, and this is important, there are connections between the bankers. One in particular, Ryan Crane, a J.P. Morgan executive with their global equities group and J.P. Morgan banker in London, who fell or jumped to his death last spring. There are connections there that they knew each other. Most importantly, it looks like these people had, well, there's a massive cleanup going of the people who knew too much or know too much. Perhaps they've discovered things prematurely. There are very wealthy, in my opinion, globalists, one's called industrialists, and the CIA, their fingerprints are all over the place on this.
This is a bizarre story. All right, Doug, thank you so much. Doug Hagman, Homeland Security U.S. Protests against the police killings of unarmed black men turned violent for a second night in California. In Oakland, demonstrators flooded a highway throwing rocks at police who responded with tear gas. Yes, one person was hit with a hammer in Berkeley trying to stop another protester from vandalizing a shop there. Authorities in suburban Chicago said a release of chlorine gas that sickened 19 people at a hotel hosting a furries convention early Sunday was intentional. The source of the gas was apparently chlorine powder left in a ninth-floor stairwell at the Hyatt Regency O'Hare Hotel. The sickened people reported nausea, dizziness. They were treated at local hospitals, 18 released shortly thereafter. The convention-goers, dressed in cartoonish animal costumes, were ushered across the street to a convention center hosting a dog show there. You might not know the name Ken Weatherwax, but he played the pudgy little son Pugsley on the 1960s ABC sitcom The Addams Family. He has died. He was 59 years old. Weatherwax died from a heart attack, according to his niece, announcing that on Facebook. That was a great show, and Pugsley was a great little actor. Sony was hit by another hack attack Monday when its PlayStation network went offline for a few hours. Customers trying to access the PlayStation store were greeted by a note saying, "Page not found. It's not you. It's the Internet's fault. Something's going on there." Crude oil fell more than $2 a barrel again to a new five-year low amid a rising number of predictions that oversupply would extend well into 2015. The OPEC member Kuwait said that it expected prices to remain in the doldrums for about 6 months. Let's check in, of course, with the human brain, Howard Bloom. I should say the human computer as well. Howard, I think the Saudis are behind this because they want to wipe out those who are doing fracking. But how low can it go?
Well, it's going to go lower. There is an excess, a glut of 2 million barrels a day. Here's the situation. It's one of the greatest roller coaster stories in history, and it's turning the world upside down right now. In 1973, remember when the Arab nations hit us with an oil embargo? Oil was $3 a barrel. By 2008, when you and I did a whole program on this, oil had rocketed to $127 a barrel, and today the price was down to half of that. It went down as far as $63.15 in trading today. It means that the average American is going to save $750 a year. It means something more important. There's going to be a positive kick for the nation's economy. It means that collectively we will save over $4.4 billion per week. And thanks to the drop in oil prices, the global economy is going to grow by an extra 0.5% to a full percent a year, which means a global economic growth of an extra $600 billion a year. There's a lot more going on here. The drop in oil prices means that what the Washington Post calls one of the greatest transfers of wealth in history, it's going to shift $1.5 trillion from oil producers to oil consumers, and it's the bad guys who are getting it in the seat of the pants. Russia, Iran, Syria, they all depend on oil revenues. Venezuela uses oil revenues to support Cuba and to promote anti-Americanisms. The Nigerians run what some call a corrupt regime, and they do it on oil income. Our friends, the Saudis, who are our allies supposedly, but they've used their oil profits to fund groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And the governments that are going to be helped, the countries that are going to be helped by these low prices are Jordan, Egypt, Israel, and Japan, all of whom, especially under the new Egyptian regime, are favorable to the United States. But the real deal here is that when China joined the world economy in 1980, the demand in China for oil was voracious, and the price of oil began to skyrocket. But guess what? As of October, China is a net energy exporter. It is no longer has that demand for oil, and something even bigger is going on here. There's a new country that has become the biggest oil producer in the world. Brace yourself. You'll never guess who it is. It's called the United States
That's
of
right.
America.
And we're back.
Right. It's producing 14 million barrels a day. Now, Russia, which is at number two, produces 50% less than that, almost 50% less, 10.9 million. Even Saudi Arabia produces only 9.9 million. We are so far ahead of them, it's ridiculous. And that's thanks to, I hate to say this, Sarah Palin got it right when she said, drill, baby, drill. It's thanks to fracking and shale oil drilling, and it seems that it's bringing manufacturing jobs back to America because the costs, the energy costs in America are becoming low. We've added 257,000 manufacturing jobs in the last 23 months.
All right, Howard, I love your insight. Thank you so much. Howard Bloom. Natural weather patterns and climate change, not man-made global warming, are causing the historic drought that's parching California, says a study from a number of federal scientists. Now, California just starting to get a little more rain and more expected, but it's got a long way to go. As a matter of fact, they say this drought is the worst in 1,200 years. Billions of years ago, a lake once filled the 96-mile-wide crater being explored by NASA's Mars rover Curiosity, bolstering evidence that the planet, most like Earth in the solar system, was suitable for microbial life. I think maybe even more than microbial life. Today marks the 71st birthday of Jim Morrison. Can you believe it? In a moment, we'll talk about Jim Morrison, friends gathered together on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, as I was mentioning. Today marks the 71st anniversary of Jim Morrison, his birthday. It's just an incredible story of this individual, what happened to him, how he died at that young age again, 27 years old. Well, Frank Lisciandro is a photographer and filmmaker. He was a close friend of the singer of The Doors, Jim Morrison. Frank attended the UCLA Film School with both Morrison and The Doors' keyboardist, Ray Manzarek, dear friend of ours who just passed away some time ago. Frank was a co-producer of the 1978 Grammy-nominated album An American Prayer, which presented Morrison's previously unheard-of spoken word recordings accompanied by some new music from the surviving Doors. We've got a little copy of a documentary up at coasttocoastam.com that Frank was part of. Just an incredible story. And Frank, welcome to Coast to Coast. It's good to have you here, especially on this day.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here, and I'd like to give a big happy birthday to Jim Morrison.
You know, just a few days ago, I was looking at Oliver Stone's movie with Val Kilmer, who I think did a pretty good job in that movie. What do you think?
Well, I thought Val Kilmer was great. I didn't think very much of the movie. I thought it was a lot of made-up stuff about a real person.
Yeah, I think you're right. Let's talk about Morrison, but tell me, how did you meet him? Give me that information. This is fascinating.
Well, we seem to have enrolled at UCLA at the same time. So although he came from Florida and I was coming from previous year at Michigan State University, we ended up at UCLA at the film school in the theater arts department at the same time. So we started taking classes together. When you start a new program, all those basic classes, the editing, the camera work, the scenic design, the acting, all of that stuff, you know, the basic preliminary classes you have to take. And Jim and I were thrown into those because we started at UCLA at the film school at the same time, and we got to know each other somewhat. Hi, how are you doing, classmates and whatnot. Then I got to know Ray Manzarek, who was also in the film school, and I got to know him quite well. And before you know it, Ray and I were hanging out together a lot. And the three of us would see each other all the time.
I had a chance several years ago, Frank, to have Robbie Krieger and Ray Manzarek on the show. And I did not know at that time that Ray was battling cancer. He didn't tell us. And he came in and, you know, Robbie was up and bubbly. And Ray, you know his personality, very low-key, not excitable. And producer Tom Danheiser and I were talking, going, gosh, I don't know. He seems like he doesn't like us or something. Ended up being one of the nicest guys I've ever met. I mean, he just, you know, he's very slow to get to know, as you probably know. But once he opens up, what a delightful guy. And he gave me a T-shirt, a Doors T-shirt, and he just was a super guy. I miss him. And, you know, just to know that we just have Robbie left, it's kind of sad, isn't it?
Well, of course, there's John Densmore, the drummer, too.
Yeah.
And, well, it is very sad losing Ray. I was at his memorial service last year, and an awful lot of people were there, and we all expressed that deep regret that he had died so young. Still active in music as a performer, as a songwriter, as a producer. A genial guy, as you said. Very heartwarming sort of guy, and a very, very clever and intelligent guy, too.
Now, tell me, in your opinion, Frank, and you wrote the book, Jim Morrison, Friends Gathered Together, tell me of the mystique behind Jim Morrison. Why did he catch on? I guess we're going to have to talk about how the Doors began, but what was that power that they had that just made this planet go crazy?
Three great musicians. And one incredible lead singer who could write like an angel, who could write lyrics that were poetry, and then perform them in the most charismatic way possible. You got guys, those three guys were jazz players, they were rock players, they were blues players. Robbie knew flamenco guitar. They could do anything musically. And with Jim out there in front of them, they could control an audience. He loved to really take an audience in the palm of his hand and take him on a trip. And, of course, the song sounded great on the radio, and they sound great today, 40-some-odd years, almost 50 years later.
We play their bumper music on the program, Frank. We're going to play some during this hour with you and take calls with you next hour from people who are fascinated with this. You had a chance to see them on their very first gig, which was in Hollywood, wasn't it?
I did see them on the first gig on the Sunset Strip. I had heard rehearsals, and I had heard a demo tape, but I did see them the first time they appeared live, and it was a disastrous evening.
What's it? What happened?
Well, you know, Jim was still very shy and still very unsure of himself, and for most of the performance, he kept his back to the audience. He wasn't trying to imitate Miles Davis. He was just unsure of himself. And his voice kind of broke a few times, and it was a little bit creaky. The band played good. And when we walked out, I turned around to my wife, and I said, you know, these friends of ours, just, you know, I wish they were going to do better than they seem to be doing. I just don't think they're going to make it. So from that day on, I never made a prediction about another band.
Well, I tell you what, they did hit their home run. At their point of popularity, how big were they? And let's look at them like the Beatles. Were they as strong as the Beatles?
Well, they were supposedly for several years or a year and a half, 18 months, maybe longer, the best-selling rock band in America. So obviously they were a powerhouse. I don't know if they outsold the Beatles or had as many hits as the Beatles or the Stones, but they were our number one band for a long time. And they would fill auditoriums, any size auditorium, and thrill an audience.
What happened in Miami, Frank? I'm looking back at the movie episode, of course, where they claim that the Jim, took his clothes off on stage and got arrested. But what happened there?
It's a pretty complicated story, and essentially Jim arrived late for the concert, and the hall manager or the whoever was promoting the concert had ripped out all the seats so we could have more people there. So suddenly this Dinnerkey Auditorium turns into a standing room only sort of concert, at least on the ground floor. There was a big fight between obviously the Doors manager, Bill Siddons, and the promoter, because the promoter didn't want to give the band more money. Jim arrives. He's late because he had an argument with Pamela. She was supposed to accompany him. He was drunk. He gets there. He had to change planes. They had to find a new schedule for him. He gets there, and he walks into this turmoil. And the audience was overheated. I've heard temperatures in the close to 100 in that space. I wasn't there that night. So I'm taking it from Vince Traynor, who was the Doors' road manager and is one of the people I had a conversation with for my book. You know, he has a chapter in the book, and he tells us all about what happened in Miami. He was right there on the spot from the moment that the equipment arrived. The promoter actually sequestered or kidnapped their equipment because he was afraid the band wasn't going to go on because of this contract that he broke. Anyway, the band finally went on, and Jim had a little bit too much to drink, and he started taunting the audience, and they were going crazy. They loved it, the audience. Before you knew it, things just weren't happening right. Did he ever expose himself? He claimed he never did. And really, if you look at the pictures, there were several hundred pictures introduced at the trial. There's not one single picture that showed that he exposed himself.
How close were you to him, Frank?
Excuse me?
How close were you to him? Was he like a dear best friend?
I'd say he was about as best a friend as I would have had at that time. We did a lot of things together. We made films together. We traveled together. We went to film festivals together. I photographed them on, I don't know, dozens of occasions. It was for a long time. We saw each other virtually every day.
Was there a part of him, Frank, that you didn't like?
You know, I would have rather not see him fall into alcoholism. Mm-hmm. And, not that he was a mean drunk, not that he was kind of a hostile or aggressive drunk. You know, Actually, he liked to play the clown for laughs and to entertain people when he was drunk. But it diminished his capacity as an artist, as a functioning human being, and I hated to see that part of it. Other than that, he was a great friend. He was generous. He was courteous. He was kind. He was humble, quiet, and discreet. What more could you say about a friend?
Yeah, that's true. Well, stay with us, Frank. We're going to come back in a moment. We're going to talk about Feast of Friends, the DVD is out, and have you tell us a little bit more about that. We're talking about the life of Jim Morrison. We'll be back. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Frank Lesiandro with us, of course, and his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Frank, tell me about the DVD documentary, Feast of Friends.
Feast of Friends was a project that was started essentially by another classmate of ours at UCLA, a friend of Jim's, a friend of mine, a friend of Ray's, Paul Ferrara, who persuaded the guys to start making a documentary about themselves. I came aboard after Paul had been shooting for a couple of months as the film editor. And I had professional experience as a film editor by that time. I had been out of school a couple of years. And so we started putting this documentary about a band, The Doors, on the road in America during the 60s. And essentially, that's what the film is. It's a look at The Doors. It's a look at America in the 60s. And, of course, a great look at Jim Morrison.
What was the point for them, Frank, when they hit it big? Who discovered them? Who pushed them? Who got behind them?
I have to admit that I was out of the country for a year during that period. And so when I left the country, they were still a struggling band. I had seen them just before I left. I was in New York, and I saw them at Ondine's, I think, in New York. And I went off to Africa for a year, came back a little bit over a year later, and they were the number one band in America when I got back. It shocked the heck out of me.
So they, I guess when they started really doing what they were doing then, they must have had a strong studio behind them, and off they went, huh?
Well, I think the record company was very much interested in making a hit band out of The Doors. And, you know, Jack Holzman's a very smart guy, knew the record business. He had a hit band with Love. And so The Doors naturally fell into place. And suddenly, when Light My Fire got on the radio, people really loved it. This is what I understand. As I said, I was far from all of this. I was in another continent, and there was no radio where I was living. And there was this tremendous outpouring of emotion, for not only for Jim, but for the music. That was it. Light My Fire caught on. That first album caught on, and by the time they made their second album, they were a number one hit band in America.
Let's move on to that moment in France, Frank. What do you think happened? And as I asked Robbie Krieger and Ray Manzarek, do you think Jim Morrison is still alive? Of course, they said no. What happened?
I wasn't there, George. I don't know what happened. I know, I've listened to all the stories. I've researched it myself, and I don't think he died of a drug overdose. Jim was an alcoholic. He wasn't a drug user. If at all, he was a light recreational drug user. So I don't see that as a possibility. He was an alcoholic. He was using asthma medication at the same time. There could have been something in that. I really can't tell you. The coroner's report, or the doctor that came and examined him — there wasn't really a coroner, but a doctor came and examined his body and said he died of heart failure. Well, that's a pretty generic term, a pretty general term. How did he die? We don't know. But I'm willing to bet that Jim did not die of a drug overdose, no matter what he died of. At 27, it's too young for an artist of his stature, his intelligence, his ability to die. And it's a shame that we lost him.
Frank, in the movie, and I know it's Hollywood, but there was a scene right before the girlfriend went into the bathroom to see him dead in the tub. There was a shot of a guy leaving the room. It was kind of a weird, surreal scene. Do you remember that?
No, I really can't recall that. But then again, as you said, it's a Hollywood bio, and we really can't depend on any of that for factuals, you know, anything factual. In fact, Robbie just recently said that he hopes that people who have seen the Stone film, Oliver Stone film, will see Feast of Friends, and I'm quoting here what Robbie said, so they'll see how Jim really was.
Yeah, well, his head was near the faucet in the tub. I don't know many people who take a bath and they put their head toward the faucet side. Their feet are always that way. I found that to be strange.
Yeah, I would find that to be strange too, George. I don't know. Again, I've done a lot of research about this. I've talked to a lot of people. Jim wrote us a letter, you know, inviting us to come and stay with him in Paris just 3 or 4 weeks before his death. The letter is, full of good cheer. He's talking about Paris. He's happy to be there. He's talking about trips they had taken. He said, we've been traveling in Spain, Morocco, southern France, and Corsica. He said, there's an extra room, so please come stay with us. This does not sound like a guy who was depressed or who was on hard drugs or who was at the end of his rope, as a lot of people have characterized him.
He would have been 71 years old today, and you must be close to his age, plus or minus. But, heck, you sound like you're 35 years old, Frank.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You do. You really do sound young. Good for you. How much do you miss him?
Oh, a lot. Doing this book has brought me back face-to-face and in touch with him again. But, you know, I miss his intelligence. I miss hanging out with him. I miss his jokes and his funny ways. Sure, I miss him. I mean, we end up missing the people we're close to in a way that's psychological and physical, I think. And, I really miss contact with him. We had a lot of fun together, and we did a lot of great projects together.
Frank, do you think he would have succeeded in the music field today with all the kinds of artists we've got and the kinds of different kinds of music? Do you think he would have still made it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. He would have been able to do anything he wanted to do. George, he had an intelligence that was off the scale. I became a filmmaker, of course, and made a lot of documentaries and interviewed a lot of people. And until I met Linus Pauling, a 2-time Nobel Prize winner, I never met anyone as intelligent as Jim.
So he was the driving force behind this great group of guys, wasn't he?
Well, I think he was the word guy. He was the intelligent word guy who spun the tales in the songs, who wrote the poetry for the songs. But I think it was a group effort. I think the three of them, the other three musicians contributed as much as Jim in their own way. You just can't have a guy standing up shouting poetry. We know where that gets you. You need the music behind him.
You sure do. Let's talk a little bit about Ray Manzarek, too. It was sad to see him go. And a great talent as well. How did they all get together? I mean, were they high school friends? What happened?
Well, Ray and Jim met at the film school at UCLA. So that's a place where a lot of things happened. They met there. They took classes together. You know, me and I was in the classes at the same time. So when they had both graduated, they met one day in Venice, and Jim read Ray some of his poetry, and Ray said, that would make great lyrics. Can you sing some of this for me? And, Jim tried to sing a few bars of some of the lyrics, and Ray said, wait a minute, I think we've got something. Let's see if we can get a band together. And how they came upon Robbie and John, I forget the story now, but I think Ray was in meditation with both Robbie and John at one point. And they were brought into the band, Robbie first, and then John, because they started out with a girl bass player, I think. I don't remember. Oh, I think one of Ray's brothers was the drummer for Ray's brother's band was the original drummer. They built it modularly, little piece at a time. First it was Jim writing the lyrics, and then Ray says, let's get the band together. Along comes Robbie. They induct Robbie into the band, and later on John, and then they started making music out of Jim's lyrics. And he had a whole notebook full of song lyrics by that time.
And Robbie is the baby of the group. I think he's only 68 years old right now.
He is a baby.
That is something else. Tell me about the dark side of Jim Morrison, Frank. You know, I don't want to dwell on that, but yeah, everybody's got that other side of them. What was his?
I think a lot of people read his poetry and read his lyrics and think that he was dwelling on death and the afterlife. I don't think so. I think he was an artist who was exploring all the possibilities of human life. You know, some of those songs do sound like he was, that, you know, that they were dark, but I just think he was an artist exploring all the possibilities. We read Byron, we might think Byron might be a little bit dark in some of his poetry, but in fact, these people have to know about everything if they're going to come back and report it to us. Jim was not obsessed with death. A lot of people say, oh, he's obsessed with death, that Morrison guy. Well, he wasn't really. He was just looking at the possibilities.
Do you think the media has distorted him?
Absolutely.
And they have.
Absolutely. And I can give you lots of examples. I could point to the first book that was published about the group and trace a history of the rumors and the urban legends and the lies, the sensationalism in that book. A lot of people have mentioned it. Even someone like their producer, Paul Rothschild, talked about that first book. He said something like, I'm furious about the book, and so is everyone else I've talked to who is quoted in it. It's a great piece of sensationalism, very little of which holds true to historical fact. Jim is sensationalized rather spectacularly, and the best part of Jim Morrison is not there. So that's a direct quote from Paul Rothschild, who is one of the best rock producers of our time and knew Jim through six studio albums. He would have known the man, and he would have known that he was not being treated fairly. And that book started an avalanche of popularity for Jim Morrison and the Doors, but the popularity of Jim became this sort of mean, some sort of crazy guy.
Yeah.
He wasn't that way. And unfortunately, sensationalism sells, and Jim Morrison, the real person, became obscured by myths and lies and rumors.
Did you know of him as the same Jim Morrison before he hit it big? Did he change at all?
You know, I want to say that he didn't, but our relationship, our friendship at UCLA was just as classmates. And we didn't have like a going out together and hanging out together kind of friendship. I was married at the time. Jim was a single guy. So, mm-hmm. You know, you don't do the same things usually.
Right.
We saw each other in class. We saw each other during the day. We did, you know, school projects together, but we didn't hang out. So I knew him as a guy in class who was kind of quiet and didn't make a whole lot of noise, was probably one of the more obscure guys around UCLA at that time. I mean, you have to remember that Coppola went to UCLA just a year before we got there. And so there were a lot of big heavyweights, a lot of people who became stars later on in the movie business who were there. Jim was just a student. And later on, when he became a big star, as I said before, I thought he was just a quiet and humble guy and didn't ever become pretentious about being a star. So there was a trait that went through from film school to stardom. He was the same person in that sort of way.
Died July 3rd, 1971. Frank, what were you doing? What do you recall that day?
We heard the news on the following day, July 4th. A friend of ours, a very good friend of Jim's, Babe Hill, was at our house, and Kevin and I were getting ready to go to Paris. To be honest with you, we had sublet our apartment. We were packing up and getting ready for a trip. Then we were going to see Jim. So it came as a gigantic shock. The next time I encountered Jim Morrison was in the grave at Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. Bill Siddons, I think, yes, Bill Siddons called us. He was on his way to Paris to help Pamela with the arrangements for the burial and all of that. And he called and told us what had happened, and we couldn't believe it. The three of us sat there just without words.
I was 21 years old. I was in Detroit at that time. I remember hearing the story, but, you know, I was busy. I was working at that time. I was a radio reporter doing what I did. I don't want to say I was in shock by it, but it was a big story. And I remember we played Doors music, you know, for a week, and you know, we had interviews and things like that. He was surely missed. What was the reaction by some of the other musicians of that time era? Do you recollect that at all?
I recollect going to the Doors office, and I had spent a lot of time there. Kathy, my wife at the time, was the Doors secretary, and we just sat in the Doors office, manning the phone, accepting all the condolence calls that were coming in. There was nonstop. People would come to the office, bring flowers, people would call on the phone. There was a constant stream of calls and people. And some of them, I think, were from other bands and who were on the strip at the time. I can't recall all of the people who came. It was a tremendous shock to L.A. This was a guy who was identified with Los Angeles. L.A. Woman was the song he wrote about the city. And so people were taken aback by it.
He, of course, died at what is called the 27 Club, at that strange age where so many great musicians passed away at an age of 27 years old. I mean, the Robert Johnsons, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison. I mean, it was just on and on and on. Amy Winehouse, 27
absolutely.
Years old. Yeah. Yes. Do you think about that at all, that 27-year-old club?
Yes, I do, and I've thought about it for a long time, and I once made a list, and I think I got up to something like a dozen or more people who had big star names and died. Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones died at 27.
Yeah.
You know, recently people have died at that age, too. I don't know what it is. Is it a jinx? Is it some sort of moment where you have to cross over, break on through to the other side? I don't know. I don't know. It didn't hit me. I got from 26 to 27 to 28 without a whole lot of difficulty. But maybe fame is too heavy for a young person.
Maybe.
Harry.
Did he live in the fast track?
Absolutely not.
He did not.
This is a guy who didn't own a luxurious house, who most of the time didn't have his own car, who walked the streets of Los Angeles, sometimes hitchhiking, stayed in a motel room near the Doors office. This was a guy who wore the same clothes for days on end. This was a guy who didn't have anything but maybe a piece of ID and a credit card in his pocket, a few bucks. Although usually he didn't have any cash.
Did he have money, though? Was he wealthy when they hit it big?
Well, the other three guys seemed to be wealthy. They had nice houses and beautiful cars and lived a luxurious life. Jim just disdained all of that. Either he disdained it or didn't know how to participate in it. I don't know.
How strange.
He was like a dropout sort of character. What was more important to him was carrying that notebook and writing poetry, doing the art thing, doing the filmmaking thing, doing the performing thing, writing the lyrics. I think that's all he thought about. His whole life was oriented into that gesture of giving back to the universe something that he had inside, making something creative.
Probably put all his money somewhere hidden in a shoebox. You never know.
Well, I think he gave a lot of it away. I think he gave Pamela a small fortune to start her her boutique in Hollywood.
Yeah.
He invested his money in a movie that he self-produced and wrote and starred in. You know, I was one of the filmmakers, one of the co-directors on that film. He gave money to itinerant artists who came to the Doors office. There was a group of muralists called the L.A. Art Squad who would come and ask Jim for some money for paint so that they could put a mural on a wall somewhere, and he was always generous giving them money. So I don't know what he did with it, but he didn't spend it in a way that was obvious.
No. It wasn't flamboyant. Frank, we're going to come back, final hour with you. We're going to take phone calls about the life of Jim Morrison on Coast to Coast AM.